Just as if it seems to know I'm exclusively yours. Knowing this, I feel but one way. You will understand it too, in these words that I say. I'll close my eyes to everyone but you, and when I do, I'll see you standing there. My heart to any other caress. I'll never say yes to a new love affair. Then I'll close my eyes to everything that's gay. If you are not there, to share each lovely day, and through the years, and those moments when we're far apart, don't you know I'll close my eyes and I'll see you with my heart.
The views and opinions expressed on this program do not necessarily represent those of KUCI, its management, or the UC Board of Regents. For more information on this or other KUCI programs, visit kuci.org or kucitalk.org.
And hello again, and welcome to Writers on Writing on 88.9 KUCI FM. We're broadcasting from the University of California, Irvine Campus. We're also on the web at kuci.org. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett. And today my guest is T. Jefferson Parker once again with his new book, L.A. Outlaws. Jeff is the best-selling author of 14 previous novels, including Storm Runners and The Fallen, and one of my favorite, Pacific Beat. Alongside Dick Francis and James Lee Burke, Jeff is one of the only three writers to be awarded the Edgar Award for Best Novel more than once. Hi there, how are you?
Oh, I'm doing well, Barbara. How are you?
Great. Great to have you on again with this book.
Yes, it's nice to be here.
You are so prolific, and I love what the LA Times said about your book in a recent review. I want to read the very last line, which is just, I think, so complimentary. The reviewer said about L.A. Outlaws, in this book a year era, in which most crime fiction feels hastily assembled from a kit, casting Parker as a mere mystery writer is a little like writing off Graham Greene's work as espionage fiction. I love that.
Mm-hmm.
Do you love that?
Yes, I do. Yeah, I couldn't have written a nicer compliment to myself. Really.
Well, you know, it's so true, and I'd love to hear you talk about how this book came about.
Well, you know, Barbara, this book, I think it had its beginnings many, many years ago. Mrs. Payne's fourth grade class, Tustin, California, California history. I was 10 years old, and we heard about Central Valley, you know, breadbasket, and we read about the Franciscan friars and the missions, and we read about California's, you know, great resources and potential, and none of that was very interesting to a 10-year-old. But what was interesting was Outlaw Week, and we studied the great California outlaws, and the one that I liked the best, my pick for outlaws, was one Joaquin Murrieta, who was a gambler and a horseman and a horse thief and a gunman and a seducer and a dresser and a drinker and a giver of things to the poor also. And he was hunted down and murdered at a very young age, and his history became legend very quickly. So reading about Joaquin as a 10-year-old, I thought, wow, now there's an outlaw to admire. So if we go forward 40 years into my novel writing moment, and I'm sitting around thinking about what to write about, I thought, gosh, you know, I'd love to somehow capture, you know, Joaquin and on the page and get to him, but I wanted to write a contemporary book because I like the here and now, and he's long gone, and I thought, well, you know, I could capture his spirit and invent his great-great-great-great-granddaughter, or at least a woman who claims to be that, who hides behind a mask and a gun and continues on Joaquin's outlaw ways. And that was probably the beginning 40 years ago and then coming forward to now.
So then how does it work? It's probably hard to say how it works exactly, but so you have a fourth grade moment and it becomes a book. Are you casting about before that moment with other ideas and trying other things out and abandoning projects some pages in, or do you wait until you really feel solidly full of that moment that you know you just have to go with?
And Yeah, I know what you mean. I kind of go with the latter, you know. I'll brood and mope and, you know, hang around the office for, you know, a month or two, 3 months sometimes before I really have something good enough in my brain to write the first sentence of what would become a book. And then it takes me another 6 months to write the draft and another 3 months to fix it. So all that boils down to about a year of work. But, yeah, for me, it's a lot of gathering and going through clip files and daydreaming and thinking about things, stories that I've overheard maybe or seen and want to change or want to update, and somehow some kind of, light goes on at some point when you realize that you have enough inside you to write that first sentence. And so there's, you know, research involved and inspiration involved and all those kind of things. And of course there was much more than just my memories of the great Joaquin to get me going on this book. You know, I've always been a great fan of the Western, and this book is essentially a modern day Western, and so that was one of the things I wanted to do, tell a story that had these big broad sort of Western movements like you might see on in a movie on television.
Yeah. Okay, and then your characters. You have really two main characters and some lesser sort of important characters, but Suzanne Jones, a.k.a. Allison Murrieta, and Charlie Hood. Talk about coming up with those two.
You know, as I mentioned, I see this book as a Western, and the lawman in my Western is a young starched shirt deputy still on patrol wearing his uniform named Charlie Hood. He's still shy of 30. He's done some interesting things in his life, two tours of Iraq. Now he's working for the Los Angeles Sheriff's Department on patrol. And correspondingly, you know, the outlaw of this modern day Western is Suzanne Jones, an eighth grade school teacher in the Los Angeles Unified District, A.K.A. also known as, calls herself Allison Murrieta when she commits these crimes at night, hidden by a mask and a wig, and again her trusty Derringer. So these are the two main characters in the book, and they kind of drive the story forward. You can only imagine the complications that arise when a nice looking, straight looking young deputy runs across a daring and beautiful woman who has essentially two identities, and the sparks that can fly and the kind of doomed clouds that kind of grow over them as the novel progresses.
Well, you know, at this point, it'd be great to just hear you read from your book. Would you do that?
Yeah, I'd be happy to do that. How about the first, just the first page and a half here, in which Allison tells us who she is.
Sure.
And okay, here goes.
If you just tune in, you're listening to Writers on Writing. T. Jefferson Parker's about to read from L.A. Outlaws.
Chapter 1. Here's the deal. I'm a direct descendant of the outlaw Joaquin Murrieta. He was a kick-ass horseman, gambler, and marksman. He stole the best horses and robbed rich Anglos at gunpoint. He loved women and seduced more than a few during his 23 years. Some of his money he gave to the poor, but to be truthful, most of it he spent on whiskey, guns, expensive tailored clothes, and on the women and children he left behind. I got Joaquin Murrieta's good looks. I got his courage and sense of justice for the poor. I got his contempt for the rich and powerful. I got his love of seduction. Like Joaquin used to, I love a good, clean, armed robbery. I steal beautiful cars instead of beautiful horses. Right now, I'm about to stick up a West Side dude for $24,000 in cash. He won't be happy, but he'll turn it over, and I'll be richer and more famous than I already am. My name is Allison Murrieta.
Thank you so much. You know, you've written main women characters before in, what was it, Red Light?
Yeah.
Blue.
The Blue Hour. And
the Blue Hour.
Blackwater, yeah.
Okay. You do it so well, and I believe these women. Talk about writing these characters, and what your concerns are, if you have any concerns, and do you run them? Do you run it by women to read, or how do you work that?
You know, good questions. I've written three books in which a woman was pretty much the protagonist before I wrote this one, in which another woman is a protagonist. I think originally I accepted the assignment as a challenge. It just seemed to me like it would be something difficult to do and challenging as a writer, and I wanted to see if I could do that. You know, I had written women before in kind of supporting roles, you know, love interests or, you know, secondary characters, what have you, and I wanted to really try to put a woman, you know, front and center, and so I did that back in the 90s with an Orange County investigator I invented by the name of Mercy Rayborn. She worked for the Orange County Sheriff's Department, and you know, I think one of the attractions for me, besides the difficulty of doing it, and you say, do you have concerns? Yeah, I'm nothing but one big concern when I write a woman and put her front and center stage, because as you know, I'm not one, and so I am prone to all sorts of sort of basic, you know, male, you know, boo-boos when it comes to writing a woman. But you kind of have to put your mask on as an author, you know, like an actor might, and play the role. And so in that it becomes entertaining and fun. I think you know, men and women, of course, are different and think different and are allowed to say different things in our world. There are some things that a man can say and do, and some things that a woman can say and do, and they don't necessarily you know, translate from one to the other. So I enjoyed the challenge of it, and when it came time to write Allison, you know, I'm writing a woman here who is she's telling you the story as we now know from that little snippet that I read, and she is our guide throughout most of the story, telling the story to us, and she's obviously from page one kind of a larger than life character, a woman who exists, you know, more in literature and in, you know, the fantasies and the fables of the masked, you know, gunman than she does really in true and genuine life. So she's an imaginary and an imaginative character, and her attitudes and her morals and her laws and the way that she lives her life are often very contrary to the written laws that we have. She is a complete outlaw from the inside out, and that's not to say that she's immoral or that she is that she's evil by any means. She just she lives by a different code than the law tells her, and when we intercept her story at the age of 32, first scene of this book, we see that she is getting away with it beautifully. And she's loving it, and she's flaunting it, and she commits these armed robberies with the mask and the gun and the wig, and so nobody knows who she really is. She commits them at night, typically, and she's always recorded, because this is 2008, so the people have their cell phones out while they're being robbed, and they video her, and they shoot pictures of her, and she hams it up for them, and she mugs for the camera, and she puts her arms around some of the victims and poses for pictures, and then she rushes home and can't wait to see whether she makes the news that night. And often she does make the news, because these are live armed robberies being pulled off by a masked woman virtually every week up in L.A., and so she has notoriety. And so her you know, her voice and her attitude and her outlandish soul is what carries this book, and if you buy into her, and if you're willing to give yourself over to Allison as a storyteller, then you will enjoy what she has to say, and you'll be pulling for her, I think.
Mm. And she has it in for certain corporations like Kentucky Fried and Burger King. Talk about that. I mean, in terms of, you know, that's, it keeps hearkening back to, you know, what's driving her to rob certain places, certain establishments.
Yeah, yeah. Allison's rationale for who she robs and who she doesn't is she has to rob from the rich, and she does, in fact, give to the poor rather generously, although she gives mainly to herself. She targets Franchise America, the Burger Kings, the McDonald's, and the Blockbusters and the Taco Bells that you mentioned, because she thinks that is corporate America at its worst. And her rule of thumb for which companies she robs the companies whose logos she's tired of seeing. And so the more golden arches she sees, the more she wants to rob McDonald's. And of course, Allison has a personal sort of grudge against Kentucky Fried Chicken, because when she worked there as a very, very young girl, she saw her beloved manager there mistreated by the corporation, mistreated by corporate KFC, if you will. And so she uses this as an excuse to hit KFCs. Now, I was a KFC employee myself also, and some of my adventures at Kentucky Fried Chicken make it into the book. And anything about Kentucky Fried Chicken in the book actually happened, and I saw it happen. So there I am, cannibalizing my little suburban Tustin life to make another book.
Oh, that was fun. That's fun. You've written characters on all sides of the law. Is it more fun to write a bad girl than a good girl being Mercy Rayburn?
Yeah. Yeah, there's something just wonderful, you know, again, hearkening back to the outlaw spirit, you know, it's just so, it's so interesting to root for the underdog and try to understand the underdog and try to pull for the underdog, even though you know that the underdog's chances of prevailing in any kind of a long run are really, really low. You know, Mercy Rayburn, the woman I wrote about a few years ago, is a very much a straight arrow and a law enforcement officer, and wants nothing more in the world to be the sheriff of Orange County. You couldn't find a more opposite personality than Allison Murrieta, Suzanne Jones, who's pulling this stuff. She wants nothing more than to be an infamous outlaw. So very, very different looks. There's something about the outlaw spirit that eludes me, but attracts me at the same time. I know that there is a difference between a criminal and an outlaw, and I'm not exactly sure where that is, but where that line is drawn. But in this book, I clearly have an outlaw, and I clearly have a villain who we haven't talked about yet. But she is, you know, she's the spirit of the outlaw, and it's delicious to write about. You know, Tom Robbins once addressed the idea of outlaw versus criminal, and he wrote something like the difference between an outlaw and a criminal is that a criminal is often a victim, and an outlaw is never a victim. And I like that. I think there's something to that. And so to write a character like that, who is courageous and swashbuckling and generous and smart and beautiful and seductive and overwhelmingly egotistical, living a life that you see cannot continue on for very much longer until something very dreadful happens, that to me is a delicious thing to write about. I couldn't take my eyes off of Allison. You know, she took the book over, as I figured she would, and I think I half fell in love with her during the writing of this thing.
Mm-hmm. And you're right. I dreaded the moment where she was going to fall.
Yeah, me too. It's coming, and we all see that it's coming, and Charlie sees that it's coming, she sees that it's coming, we all see that it's coming, and of course, you know, what the book really is kind of about in a more general sense is the consequences of what you do, and she talks about that with Charlie, and he talks about that with her, and they just flat out disagree on how a person should live their life.
Mm. You're listening to Writers on Writing. I'm with T. Jefferson Parker, author of the new novel, L.A. Outlaws. Okay, you mentioned the villain, Lupercio. He really is sort of multidimensional, and I mean, all your characters always are, and I find it really interesting that, you know, he has all this psychopathic behavior, and yet he's a family man. Can you talk about him and the development of his character?
Sure, sure. Lupercio Megar, yeah. He is a product, he's a Salvadoran, a product of El Salvador, and he was born there and lived his, you know, boyhood and early manhood there during the 80s when there was so much torture and execution and just turmoil and murder in that poor, unfortunate country. And he was as a young man saw his, you know, his father murdered and his brother murdered, you know, picking pieces of their bodies out of the pile of body parts that would, you know, magically appear at the bottom of this cliff every morning, El Diablo, I think it was called. And Joan Didion has written beautifully about that in Salvador, if you want a little sort of hard background. He grows up through all this, and he comes to the United States, and like a lot of Salvadoran refugees, they came to Los Angeles, Southern California, and they would frequent MacArthur Park, and around that area, MacArthur Park, in the late 80s, and Los Angeles, the Salvadoran immigrants, you know, refugees, came together and formed a gang for protection and for profit, etc. And that gang, they called themselves the Mara Salvatruca. It doesn't have a literal translation, I don't believe. Mara Salvatruca or MS-13. And they profited and they thrived because they were tough and they were resourceful and they were well-armed because of the thousands of weapons left behind by the United States down there arming the rebels and the Contras, rather. And so they thrived as a gang, and they grew, and they enlisted, conscripted other nationalities. They didn't limit their gang to Salvadoran guys, Mexican or whatever. It was open. It was equal opportunity, and they were more than happy to cross state lines doing terrible things. They became very violent, very profitable, and by year 2000, they were the only street gang in the United States that the FBI had a specific unit to fight. They were so dangerous, hideously violent, and also very smart. So anyway, Lupercio is one of the founders of the Mara Salvatruca, and yet they cannot even abide his relentless and ruthless acts. So they come to a parting of the ways, him and his old gang. They kind of make a handshake deal after great bloodshed. They leave him alone, and he leaves them alone. So he is now a rogue man, and what he does is he lives his criminal life, collecting things, stealing things, taking jobs for even higher-ranking men who need things stolen or people murdered. He's a very, very intense guy, and he's not greedy. He lives modestly. He saves most of his great treasure in a series of safes he has in his home, and he'll drag out the jewels and the watches and the cash and look at it sometimes. But he lives very modestly in Adelanto with his loving wife and two daughters. And we see him at home a couple of times. We see him. There's a scene where he gets his hair cut by his daughter, and they talk about the style and everything. And we see that he has these nice qualities. I think that's kind of interesting. You know, he's not really a machine. I don't think there are machines out there, really. But there are people out there who do terrible things. A detective friend of mine in Los Angeles, he made a comment once about, yeah, you really got Lupercio right, because I see those guys all the time. They're the multiple murderers, but when I see them, they're out hanging the Christmas lights in front of their house,
right.
You know? And so we all have a good life and a bad life, I guess, to different degrees. And Lupercio is that relentless. What he is to me in the novel is consequence itself. He's practically fate, because once you cross his path, you have brought him into your life. And when Allison, early in the book, steals $450,000 worth of loose, uncut, gem quality diamonds, when she steals those, she unleashes Lupercio's hell onto herself and onto Charlie unknowingly. So as Allison is thinking that she's the antagonist in this book, actually she isn't. Lupercio is, and she activates him by what she does, and he becomes her fate and her consequence. And how she is going to deal with him and he with her is the central driver of the book.
Hmm. Now, did you know all that before you started writing?
I knew a little bit about MS-13. I think gangs are interesting, and I read about them, and I know, you know, some people on the edges, and I know policemen who work very closely with them, and I'm intrigued by that world. You know, maybe maybe I'm looking for the, you know, maybe I'm looking for a modern day outlaw when I when I look at these people. I don't know, but I'm fascinated by it, you know. And MS-13 is obviously very interesting. They got a lot of ink a few years ago. I haven't read, you know, too much recently about MS-13 you know, activity or anything, but I think they're a fascinating group. I think all street gangs are hierarchies, and they're, you know, they're turf, and their behavior is very interesting to me.
And as far as theme, what you said about how Allison / Suzanne and Lupercio are connected, did you have that before you wrote, or does the theme emerge as you're writing?
You know, I had that much of it, Barbara. I saw it early on as a you know, a kind of a three player play. You know, we've got this you know, this straight person and this outlaw, and then above them and kind of shadowing them, if you will, is this third force, you know. And so I kind of had that early, and I thought it would work. I know it would work because I've seen it done a million times before. It's a pattern, or not a formula maybe, but it's one of those plots that work. And I thought I could pull it off, and one of the beauties of having three very strong, powerful characters on, you know, available at the same time for your storytelling is that you can move your point of view around. And this book is Allison tells her story, Allison-Suzanne, first person, like when I read. She tells you her part of the story, if you will, and then Hood doesn't tell you anything. You just watch over Hood's shoulder, and you see him kind of track her through the things and realize finally who she really is and what he's going to do about it. And then the third character, Lupercio, again, you see over his shoulder, and you kind of get to watch him move through the book. So it makes for three really nice different chords, if you will, and when you alternate them properly and arrange them right, then you get a real nice it's interesting, and the pace can be really fast, and you can and you've got some movement. You're not stuck with one first person narrator for, you know, 350 pages or strictly a third person, you know, omniscient sort of look. So it mixes up, it harmonizes really nicely. It's nice. I like multiple character books. I started off not doing that because it's hard, and later now I think I can do it, and I enjoy that kind of manipulation and that kind of the kind of lightness on your feet that you can suggest by moving these three characters around into their various arrangements and making that story happen as you read.
Interesting. Well, we have a ton more to talk about, so all of you out there, stay with us. We'll be back in just a few minutes with more T. Jefferson Parker.
Come back, baby, please don't go. No, I love you, darling, hate to see you go. Come back, baby, let's talk it over one more time. My heart's full of sorrow, mama aching tears. Be gone 24 hours, child, seem like a thousand years. Come back, baby, let's talk it over one more time. Darling, Rome wasn't built in a day. Let's talk it over before you go away. Come back, baby, let's talk it over one more time.
debunk in the idiocy of coincidence theorists with me, Robert Larson, on Out the Rabbit Hole, Fridays, 3 to 4 p.m., KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine.
Weekly Signals, every Tuesday morning from 8 to 9 a.m. Join me, Mike Casper, and Nathan Callahan for the best in reality-based radio. That's Weekly Signals. Check out the website at weeklysignals.com.
And you don't hear none of those stations playing them. Ask why. In fact, where are those stations today? Somebody better ask somebody that. The people that's most affected by this war.
From animal rights and the anti-war movement to civil disobedience and culture jamming, Justice or Just Us examines law, equality, public policy, and social activism. Tune in Thursdays 8 to 9 a.m. on KUCI in Irvine and KUCI.org.
The views and opinions expressed on this program do not necessarily represent those of KUCI, its management, or the UC Board of Regents. For more information on this or other KUCI programs, visit kuci.org or kucitalk.org.
And welcome back to Writers on Writing on 88.9 KUCI FM. We're broadcasting from the University of California, Irvine campus, and we're on the web at kuci.org. We're also accessible via iTunes. If you go to iTunes, go to Public Radio, scan down for KUCI FM. You can get us there. You can also go to my website at penonfire.com. Click on the radio tower on the left side of the page. You'll hit the radio page and lots of instructions about how to get there as well. We podcast. We have 200 some shows up, also accessible from my website. This one will go up in another week or two and be there for as long as, be there forever, okay? It'll just be there forever. And I'm with T. Jefferson Parker, who is author of many books. His latest is L.A. Outlaws. Hi there. One thing that really differentiates you from other crime writers or writers of suspense fiction is you always have a compelling love story threaded throughout your novel. I love that. I love that your work is layered with lots of different things going on. Will you talk about that?
Yeah, happy to. I don't know. I think I secretly always wanted to be a romance writer. I didn't think it would be seemly or something. I don't know. That's true. That's totally true. I always put a romance in, whether it's a romance that's building or a marriage that's falling apart or something. I think it touches us all, and it's kind of one of the universal things that makes us all tick. And when I'm reading a novel, I like that. I like to see a novelist try to take on a relationship, a couple, and intercept it and display it for us. I think it's endlessly kind of interesting. So, yeah, I like love, and I think it's important. And, love and the falling apart of love kind of equally important, and I've written about them both. And love is much more fun to write about, I will say that, than the end of love. There's a big, fat, romantic, river running through the middle of this novel between Charlie and Suzanne. And, again, as we talked about earlier, we the readers, see how doomed it is, it is likely to be. But in that, I think, comes through that comes an extra layer of tension and of gravity, if you will, because we realize that what Allison and Charlie are doing their lives are at stake, especially hers. So this is truly kind of a life and death romance, and that takes me back to some of the great romances, Shakespeare's romances, where it's more than just love and happiness on the line; it's life itself.
The other thing is, and I remember when you came on after 9/11 with the book that followed that time, and you said that right after 9/11, I think you said you had a hard time writing, mm-hmm. and you didn't know quite what to do with it all. I mean, that it was, just how could you sit down and write after something like that, come up with something. And Charlie part of his story in this book is that he was in Iraq and has history there and has nightmares from there and all sorts of things. Talk about incorporating that into his character and into the book.
Yeah, Charlie has done two tours of Iraq as an investigator for the Naval Criminal Investigative Service, NCIS, and their job is to investigate crimes overseas in the military theater. I live in a little town called Fallbrook, which is on right on the edge of Camp Pendleton in North San Diego County, and several of the soldiers who were accused of war crimes, if you will, in Iraq over the past few years were stationed there and then were taken back there for trial. And their trials were covered really heavily by the San Diego Union Tribune, which is the newspaper that I read. And so I saw that stuff kind of front page every day for a couple of years. There were several kind of atrocities that were being investigated involving our own soldiers. And that hit me hard because I know some of these soldiers and families of soldiers who are there, and I know the great earnestness and bravery and valor and high intentions that our soldiers have over there. And to see things go terribly wrong, it just kind of breaks my heart, you know. And I thought I'm gonna have Charlie be a witness to this, and I'm gonna have him bring his knowledge of that home to Los Angeles. And what Charlie's doing is he's looking for. He's looking for a code. He's looking for a law to believe in. He's looking for something to hold on to. And he thought it was the law in Iraq, but he sees these men doing things they're not supposed to be doing for very understandable reasons. And he's not sure what to make of it. He does as good as he can over there with the cases that he's given. But there's one that haunts him particularly because he knows that one of the soldiers has taken a rap for several other soldiers who did worse things. And he just can't find any justice. And his search for that continues in the States as a law enforcement officer in Los Angeles. He's faced with the same kinds of compromised circumstances, and he's looking for the code and the law and what is right and what is doable. And I think that Iraq has been tragic and destructive on many, many, many levels, not even mentioned in this book, but just one of them is the terrible predicaments that our people have found themselves in over there, and I wanted to touch on that. You have to put in what's going on in the world a little bit. This book is not about world affairs, but it has a little bit of that in there, and it sets the story nicely, and it simply has to be talked about a little bit.
Also, regarding Charlie, his name, Charles Hood. Okay. Suzanne calls her alias sort of Robin Hood. And early on, it does seem that she's stealing from the rich and giving to the poor. Names. How significant is this? How significant is his name? Is it something you thought about? Do you think about names and their symbolic value?
Yeah, I have two answers to the same question, and they're both funny. The first one is I based Hood's name on I took the last name of my electrician in Fallbrook. His name is Hood. His name is Barry Hood, and I just think it's the coolest name. So I took it and I said, I'm my new hero, whoever he is. His name's going to be Charlie Hood because I just thought it was a perfect name. So, but the serious answer to the same question is that. I love stories about duplicitous characters. I love stories about people who are not what they seem. I love stories about guys who wear masks or women. I love that Peter Parker puts on a mask and becomes Spider-Man.
Yeah.
And Clark Kent puts on the mask and becomes Superman. And I love that duality. And to me, what a masking story really is about, it's about unmasking. And so, during the course of these stories, there's always a character who starts to get it, you know, like that moment in the Spider-Man movie when Kirsten Dunst finally, starts to realize, he's pretty sure that Peter Parker actually is Spider-Man. That is a wonderful moment to me. You know, that brings tears to my sentimental little eyes. You know, I just think that that's wonderful. And so, in this story, Hood is the guy who sees. He's the seer. He meets Suzanne and he interviews her opening night, second scene in the book. He interviews her because he pulls her over because she's speeding in a bleak out of the way part of LA County. She's speeding in a beautiful yellow Corvette, and he pulls her over. So he meets this Suzanne, and he asks her questions and asks her where she lives and checks her driver's license and registration and all that kind of stuff. And then slightly later in the book, he's witnessing Allison Marietta displayed in, you know, big monitors at the sheriff's department, where these guys are trying to figure out how they can stop this crazy masked woman who's holding people up at gunpoint. And at one point during the broadcast, Allison walks away from the cameras during one of her robberies, and Hood looks at the way the back of her blouse creases as she moves away, and he remembers the way the back of Suzanne Jones's blouse creased when he had pulled her over like a week before, and he says right there, he says, I think it's the same woman, and nobody has this idea except for him. So he's the unmasker, and so Hood, what a perfect name.
Mm-hmm. It was a perfect name. Also, you're telling details. You have, you know, that's one of them, what you just mentioned, him noticing how the blouses are the same crease. Ruth, Suzanne's lawyer, later on in the book, you have her lighting a cigarette with what Suzanne calls basically a flamethrower. That's such a great detail for this little 5-foot-tall lawyer.
Isn't that funny? Yeah. I don't know where I got that. It's one of those fireplace lighters, you know, that throw the flame really hard.
But it tells about her character so well, more than probably anything else you could possibly say. Do those sorts of things just come to you? I mean, it sounds like they do just come to you.
Yeah, that one did. You know, it was winter time when I was writing that passage, and every morning when I get up and go to my little metal building office, the first thing I do is I light a fire in the fireplace, the firebox, because it's cold out there. And so I live with those little flamethrower lighters. Really work well, you know. And when I imagine this lawyer, this very diminutive, you know, super brilliant, aggressive, successful L.A., you know, criminal lawyer, this tiny little woman, you know, secretly smoking in her Century City office, you know, something she'd never do in public. And of course she has to light her cigarette with a flamethrower.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's perfect. You're listening to Writers on Writing. I'm talking with T. Jefferson Parker, author of L.A. Outlaws. Also regarding Ruth, and this is another point having to do with you layering it all in, and it's wonderful to come across this kind of stuff in your books, but there's like shades of Citizen Kane in here on on 320 when Ruth speaks of an old flame she had 40 years ago. You know, she says, I had a guy like that.
Oh, yeah.
And were you thinking of Citizen Kane, or was that like just... I'm just pulling it out of what I think was happening there.
You know, I didn't pull it out of Citizen Kane, but I see the parallel you're talking about. And what I was digging at in that one is that all of us have, I think we have some ferocious romance from the past that's unsolved. You know, it may have been never even consummated, or it may have been consummated and then abandoned. There's some sort of flame of romance that is there, even if it's just like, you know, Donald from the second grade or something, you know. and so I thought the idea, again, that this diminutive, small, tiny little high-powered lawyer, you know, would take a moment out of her extremely busy and profitable day to reflect that, I had one of those once, and then the next thing she says, it's in the same sentence, I think, is something like, I love my husband, you know?
Right.
And so, you know, back to reality.
Mm-hmm. I love that, though. I mean, because, yeah, that is how we are. Mm-hmm. And it's such an interesting sort of, I don't know, just different characteristics that you give Ruth that kind of conflict and at the same time go to make her this really interesting, sudden character who's there for a very short time but is powerful for a very short time.
Yeah, she sees the truth also.
Yeah, yeah. A little more on sort of the process, because listeners always seem to like to hear about the process. In terms of keeping all these pieces together and apart and enabling you to see what's going on in your book, where you're headed, what does your office, what does your studio look like? Do you have... a board where you have things posted so that you know where you're going and you can follow threads? Do you have visuals of the plot sort of sketched out somewhere? Talk about that. Talk about actually sort of getting it done.
Okay. Yeah. You know, my office is scarcely controlled chaos. It's a total mess. It's a metal building that's outside the home, of course. It's like a little machine shop, and a part of it is finished off with windows and carpet and an air conditioner and a fireplace, and it's pretty nice, really. But inside there's nothing really to recommend it but 1,000 books and a billion fishing pictures, you know, hung on the walls with scotch tape. You know, outlining wise and stuff on a book like this, that has the proper ingredients, if you will, those three characters that we've talked about, and kind of the general idea that we're writing a Western and it's a book about consequence and a woman, seeking celebrity on television and all this kind of stuff. Once you have the kind of players in place, a novel like this, in my case anyway, kind of wrote itself. I didn't really have to outline this very. I didn't outline it. It just kind of starts, and then it appears to have evolved organically during the telling. And in fact, that's what happened. There was no real cagey outlining done underneath this as a point of structure. It just kind of came together in the right way, and I could tell that it was when I was writing it. And I didn't want to get in the way and try to get hyper organized about it or anything. So I just let the story kind of unfold the best way that I could. And of course, when you do that, you always come to doomsday, and it's about 100 pages from the end of the book. You can figure there's another about 100 pages you need to finish the story, but you're not sure how you're going to finish it. And as you can tell, and as the listeners will probably have surmised, when you have Charlie and Allison and Lupercio here, this three ring, this triumvirate, there are people with such capacity and capability and potential for things. Anything can happen. Anything can happen. And I listed them at that point. I went down the checklist. I go, well, Allison can live. Allison can die. She can quit. She can get arrested. She can fall in love with Hood. He can fall in love with her. Just down, 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 down. They can deal with Lupercio. Or Lupercio can win, and he can rub her out, and he can be arrested by. Just there's a million different ways that you could end that book. And so my job then as an author at that point is simply to sift through and ask myself what the book needs, what the story needs, and do what the story needs. And it has nothing to do with my next book or writing a sequel or whether or not it's going to be made into a movie or any of that stuff. All it is, it's all subordinate to what that story needs to leave you readers feeling completely satisfied with the tale. And at that point, I just kind of crossed off the ones that I didn't like, and I figured, yep, I can see it. I think that this should happen here, and I'm pretty sure this is the way it should go. And then when you get your agent and your publisher and in my case my wife Rita reading that for the first time, I know that they're going to tell me if it's not right, because it's so obvious whether it's going to be right or not. And all three of them came back and said, perfect ending, it's the way the book should have gone. So I was happy.
Mm-hmm. So how many drafts do you put your book through?
Pardon?
How many drafts do you tend to go through?
Let's see. I do one big fat draft now, and I try to take my time on it and do it as well as I can. And then I end up rewriting a lot. I always budget a month or two to sometimes three to kind of go through again and again and again and work on things. But as far as genuine real drafts, when you talk about a draft of a novel, I do one, and then I work on it a lot. I start chipping away at it.
Mm. Will you read to us one more time?
Oh, I'd like to. Yeah, I've got a nice passage here where Charlie comes across the same crime scene that Allison comes across, where she steals the $450,000 worth of diamonds. Barbara, this is 1, 2, 3 pages long. Do we have that much time?
I think so.
Okay, I'm going to read. Chapter 5. Charlie Hood looked at the brightly lit office lobby that was never lit at 3 a.m. Then he climbed the steps to the front door and looked in at the stillness. He saw the overturned chair and the threshold of the office, and then looked down the hallway leading to the bay. He tried the door and felt the bolt knock against the lock plate and the housing. He looked out to where the 710 crossed over Interstate 10 and listened to the steady, toneless roar of the cars. Hood took the catwalk around one side of the warehouse and looked through the first window he came to at the cars and the whirring fans and the lilting curtains sprayed in various colors and the dead people strewn across the floor. It looked like an Anbar alleyway in 04. From the next window down, he saw five more dead. He waited for a long time for something to move other than the curtains and the fan blades, but nothing did. He went back to the unit and called in backup and 10 bodies worth of coroners, paramedics, and the homicide gang units. He sat on the metal steps, with his arms on his knees, looking at the parked cars and wondering what kind of hell the Wilton Street Asian boys had stirred up. After a minute, he lit 3 ground flares at the entrance of the parking area to keep the county vehicles away from driving in and wrecking the evidence. Within an hour, there were 13 men and women on scene and an entry-exit log taped to the front window next to the door that a deputy had forced open with a 4-foot pry bar. The homicide sergeant was Bill Marlin. He was pale-complected and black-haired and not young. When the door fell open, he motioned Hood in ahead of him, a courtesy to the first responder that surprised and pleased Hood. "Sign in, everybody," said Marlin. "The usual, look, don't touch." Hood scribbled his name on the log and stepped in. He glanced at the office and the overturned chair. With his hand on the butt of his service weapon and his ears and eyes alert, Hood moved through the open counter door, then slowly down the hall toward the bay. Hood recognized 3 of the dead as Wilton Street crazy boys. Another, no more than a boy, the one with the painter's mask still on, looked familiar, but Hood couldn't place him. The other Asian was new to him. Maybe another boy clique, he thought. The 4 Latins were Mara Salvatrucha by the tattoos, but hard to say where they came from because MS-13 wasn't about turf, but about money and violence. Hood scrolled back through his almost 4 years in the sheriff's, trying to remember Mara Salvatrucha and the crazy boys mixing it up, but couldn't think of one incident. "Haven't seen much of this," he said to Marlin. "Different gangs fighting it out." "I wonder if anyone walked away," said Marlin. "Funny they'd leave the guns." Marlin nodded. "If there was a winner, I'd put my money on the Salvadorans. I wish this guy could talk." They were standing next to a dead man dressed in a black suit with a white open-collared shirt and a pair of full black dress shoes splayed out at the end of his thick legs. To Hood, shoes had come to seem irrelevant on dead men, of whom he had seen more than several in his 28 years. The racks in El Anbar wore sandals or nothing, so to him, death was a shoeless thing. He looked at the 4 holes in a diagonal line across the front of the white shirt, automatic fire from the Salvadorans, almost for sure. The guy had no gun, apparently. He looked wrong here, like he'd wandered in from another time and place. Without turning him over, Marlin worried out the man's wallet and stood. "Barry Cohen," he said. "Hollywood. Cohen and Cohen Gemstones in the Diamond District," says this business card. "What's a nice Jewish boy doing at this party?" Hood had been thinking the same thing. "Maybe it was his party," he said. "Him and the Asians. This is their turf. Maybe the Salvadorans crashed it." Marlin nodded, but didn't look away from the bodies. "Him and the Asians doing what?" "Well, diamonds come to mind," said Hood. Marlin put his hands on his hips and looked down at the bloody heap of dead men. "Looks like Coochie." "Or Hamdaniah," said Hood. 10 men. Jesus. Marlin had invited Hood one evening after work to a bar where they drank and agreed that war is worse than hell because hell punishes sinners, but war punishes everyone.
Thank you so much. That was T. Jefferson Parker reading from L.A. Outlaws. We have 2 minutes left. Not nearly enough time to cover everything else. So let me just ask you something that I think a lot of writers I know right now would like to hear about, and that is writing through difficulty. Anybody knows that you have, and that you just keep going, and you are prolific despite whatever else is going on. Can you give some advice regarding that?
Well, you know, for me, writing is. Writing really can help you. You know, it gives a body something constructive to do, and through tragedy and joy and whatever else might be going on in your life, the writing can help anchor you, and it certainly has helped anchor me, and so I look to it. And that is not to say that when things are going poorly in the story or poorly at some part of your life that sitting down to work on a novel is a joy. It certainly isn't sometimes, but often it is, and it's certainly always something that is engaging enough to take your mind off of things for a while, and in a way it might provide the author with the same kind of escape and diversion that it does, you know, eventually supply to the reader. Yeah, and I'm kind of a chronic worker anyway. I like my job and I like to work. Even when it's going poorly, I kind of feel stubbornly bound to stick with it and try to make something good happen.
Well, thank you so much for giving us another wonderful book.
Thank you. It's really nice to be on your show and to be asked good questions, and I'll come back anytime.
Excellent. Thank you, Jeff.
Thank you.
That was T. Jefferson Parker. He's speaking to us from Chicago, I think, where he's on book tour. He'll be out this way, back this way, and if you go to his website, which is tjeffersonparker.com, or just Google his name, you'll find out a schedule, and he's doing a bunch of stuff in L.A., and great, it'd be great for you to get out there and meet him, go to a reading, go to a talk, and see him firsthand. If you want to know more about the show, go to my website at penonfire.com. You can email me from there if you want to be on my weekly email list. I'm going to leave you with a quote by Somerset Maugham, who said, "The only important thing in a book is the meaning it has for you." Thank you for listening to Writers on Writing on 88.9 FM KUCI. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett. I'll see you next time.